Welcome to the Last Round MMA.
The guy's never beaten me. In order to be the champion, you have to beat the champion.
A podcast for the MMA fan.
Imagine that. Look at everybody up here. They're all dressed like me. They're all trying to talk like me. They're all trying to be me.
Bringing you in-depth interviews and more from across the MMA world.
This is like pride. You know, everybody's here. I feel great. And, you know, I can't wait. Saturday night, I'm going to crush this guy hype.
Are you ready? Let's start the show.
Welcome to the Last Round MMA. And today's guest is the former head of Nevada State Athletic Commission and now working for the UFC as VP of Regulatory Affairs, Mark Ratner. Thanks for joining me, Mark.
I'm delighted. I'm happy to talk with you.
All right, let's jump straight into it. So where did you grow up, Mark, and how did you get into combat sports?
I was originally born in Arizona and moved to Nevada probably 60 years ago. And big boxing fan, used to go to the fights and involved in other sports. And one of my close friends was a judge with the Nevada Athletic Commission. And he said in the probably around 1984, why don't you learn to be an inspector and work for the commission? I worked in the back rooms, paid the fighters, checked their gloves, that kind of things. And my friend, he passed away, but he became the director in 1987, and I became his chief inspector. And then when he passed away, I became the director in 1992.
So when you first started, was that like a part-time role? Was it a voluntary role?
It was a part-time role until I went to becoming a full-time executive director. But yeah, part-time, avocation, love going to the fights, being in the back rooms. My big highlight was being in Ray Leonard's dressing room when he fought Marvin Hagler. I was the inspector there with Angelo Dundee. That was one of my favorite moments as an inspector.
And when you first start, like, how do you learn the ropes and how does it work? Do you start off with small jobs and then work up, obviously, to the bigger jobs when you get more experience?
Yes. First thing, I went to an old-timer's gym here. His name is Johnny Toko. He showed us the proper ways to wrap. He was Sonny Liston's trainer at one time, and he had a place called Ringside Gym, and he showed us how people can cheat, different cut solutions, and that's how you learn.
So for people that are listening that are kind of intrigued by this and think, you know, they want to follow in your footsteps and go into that role, that's something that you would encourage them to go down to local boxing gyms, kind of, you know, watch and learn?
I would say, first of all, you just can't walk into a gym. I mean, if they'll let you, that's fine. I would get involved with your state commission, your local commission, and say you want to learn to be an inspector, and then they can assign you. It's a big process. It's probably in Nevada, they probably have 100 people waiting to become an inspector. It's a great job. Doesn't pay a lot, maybe $100 a fight, $125, so extra money.
Mm. And whilst you were doing this, what were you at college? Were you working?
When I became an inspector, I was working family business, beauty and barber supply business, and I would go to fights and they would see me. And so, it was an avocation, not a probably paid maybe $50 a fight card for me in those days.
I saw you said it in the previous interview, you used to actually carry around boxers' trunks just in case they were needed in your car.
When I became the chief inspector, I carried different sizes, different colors of trunks with me, as well as I always had the backup gloves, extra sets of backup gloves in case somebody ripped their gloves.
So when you actually became like the chief inspector, could you really sit back and enjoy the fights? Or were you more concerned about it running smoothly?
As a chief inspector, I was more concerned with paying the fighters, making sure all the inspectors did their job. As the director in 1992, then everything was under my purview. And I always thought the main concern was getting him into the ring. But as I got more and more experience, the main thing was safety and health and getting him out of the ring.
One of the first fights I think you did, or one of the fights you did, was you actually worked one of Floyd Mayweather's first fights.
He became a pro. I was the director in a little casino here. I believe it was called Texas Station. Yeah, I probably saw him fight maybe 19, 20 times. And even in Atlantic City, I saw him fight. Probably the best fighter of this modern era that I've ever seen.
And could you tell from that first fight that there was something special about him?
I knew how fast he was. I was very familiar with his uncle Roger, so I knew the lineage. Roger Mayweather was a former champion, a great, great fighter. And so I always thought, and Floyd did well in the Olympics. I always thought there was he was going to do fine.
So did you come, Mark, from a boxing family, a big sports fan family?
No, my parents were not really sports minded as much. I just loved going to fights, as well as I became an official in the early 60s for American football, basketball, softball. So I was always an official, and that really helped me coming to boxing.
Just we'll look back at, you know, three of the most kind of craziest fights, I guess, that you were involved in. So you were actually present for the Fan Man at Caesar's Palace during 1993, involving Riddick Bowe and Holyfield. What can you remember about that fight?
I've been discussing it for the last 25 years, but or more. What I remember is there's a certain sound in the stands that you know something's going on behind you. It's usually a fight in the stands. And I heard this little buzzing, but I didn't think anything of it. The round was going on, and I'm watching the fighters intensely, and all of a sudden I see Bo stop, and then this guy comes out of the sky. I never saw him, and with a fan attached to himself and a parachute, and landed right in the ropes, and all hell broke loose. The two main things that I always want to bring up is Michael Buffer's calmness, how he kept the crowd crazy. And if it would have happened in 2003, it would have been a major riot because people would have thought it was some kind of terrorism act. But my mistake was that night, it was a cool night in November, I believe, I didn't send Holyfield and Bo back to their dressing rooms. I didn't know how long the delay was, if the fight would continue. The fight continued for 21 minutes of the intermission there. And I had to go to tell each judge, look, if this fight goes on, you have to score that round. And one judge had it for Evander, one for Riddick, and one had it even. And if the judge who had it even would have given the round to Riddick, then the fight would have been a majority draw, and Bo would have kept his title. So it changed heavyweight history.
And since that day, has anything changed in kind of the procedures? I mean, I can't see it happening again, but you never know.
Well, certainly nothing in the rule book says, what do you do when a guy flies into the ring?
Right.
No, nothing like that's happened anywhere in the world, to my knowledge. It was a bizarre, wild night, and I really believe a one of a kind. What can you change? It was outside, and one of the most iconic venues at Caesar's Palace. I just don't ever foresee it happening anywhere.
It's one of the things you just said then, like, you know, like today, if that happened today, I think most people would think, you know, it was some type of, you know, terrorist attack, and it could, you know, cause a kind of like a melee.
Right, it would.
One of the second fights that you've worked was Holyfield Tyson, the bite fight at the MGM Grand in 1997. Just tell us what went through your mind during that event.
Another of my wild, wild, bizarre nights. First of all, the irony is that Mills Lane was the referee in that fight, as well as the Fan Man. And also one of the best referees in the history of boxing. And just a little backstory. In the first fight, there was a referee named Mitch Halpern who was assigned. Tyson's camp objected to, because they didn't think that, for whatever reasons, he was the right guy. He did a fine job in the first fight. The athletic commission said, we'll keep him. He did nothing wrong. And Mitch Halpern on Thursday night before the Saturday said, I don't want to be the center of this. I'm not going to accept the fight. Therefore, Mills came in, and for Mitch to turn it down was a $10,000 payday. So it was a tremendous payday, but he did, and he ended up doing what exactly was right. That night, walking into the arena, and I get there a couple hours early, there was a different kind of crowd in the fact that they were lining the hallways. Not everybody, it was a sellout and stuff. And lo and behold, in the third round, Mike, and I believe this is what he was thinking, he butted him, and then Mike he bit his ear. Mills Lane called me up, and he said, it's going to disqualify him. And I just asked, as a college referee, I said, are you sure you want to disqualify him? Because I didn't understand exactly what happened. He said, let's bring the doctor up. We brought the doctor up, Dr. Homansky. He said, he can continue. And Mike did it again, and the fight was over, and Mike was disqualified.
In hindsight, Mark, would you have disqualified him the first time now, or you're happy with how it went?
You know, if Mike would have knocked out Evander after the first bite, then you wouldn't be talking to me today. That would have probably been the end of my career. So looking back, I think I did exactly what should be done as an official. And I, when it first happened, when Mills called me up, I really thought that maybe Mike had had pinched his cup or something, and that hurt him. That's why he was jumping up and down. I didn't know that it was a bite until Mills called me over.
And afterwards, Mike Tyson was actually fined, you know, $3 million, and his license was revoked.
Right.
Just tell us that process and how you came to the $3 million amount. Was that like a percentage of his purse?
Yeah, 10% of his announced purse that night. The commission, and I wasn't a commission, I'm just part of the commission, decided to revoke his license, which means you can reapply after 1 year. And the fine was 10% of $30 million, $3 million went into the, quote, general fund of the state of Nevada. Maybe paid teachers, did highway work, so it was put to good use.
And after the fight, there was actually some panic where they thought there was some shots fired. Can you remember that night and what happened?
Well, I remember the panic. I saw people screaming in the hotel. The hotel said there was never shots fired, but I did see panic with the audience running outside. I went out by the pool, get away from it all, and got to my car. So it was scary that night, but it's fun to talk about today, but 25 years ago, it's a crazy time.
And the third fight I wanted to look at is Floyd Mayweather against Zab Judah. What can you remember from that fight?
Richard Steele was a referee. Zab, in the first four rounds, was just as quick as Floyd. And probably it might have been 2-2 at the end of four, something like that. Zab was doing great. And then Floyd's experience and his boxing wherewithal started to slow Zab down, and was starting to win the fight pretty easy. Now we come, I think it's to the 10th round, and Zab hits him low. Floyd bends over in pain, and then Zab hit him in the back of the head. Floyd's Uncle Roger jumped into the ring, and Zab's father, Yoel, jumped into the ring. We had a melee. The interesting thing is Floyd went to the neutral corner, put his arms on the ropes, and stayed out of it. Mm-hmm. We had several fines. Roger was fined. Zab Judah's father was fined. Zab was fined. I believe Leonard Ellerbe, Floyd's manager at that time, or trainer, he was fined. It was big, and it was terrible, but I thought we did what was right. Some people thought I should have disqualified Floyd for Roger jumping in the ring, but that made no sense to disqualify him there. After we settled it down, the fight went to its natural conclusion, and Floyd won the fight.
So not long after that, I believe, is when you joined the UFC. So when did you first hear about MMA and the UFC?
I first heard about MMA in the late 2000s. At that time, I was still with the commission, and I knew that Dana and Lorenzo were looking at this sport called mixed martial arts. I was able to get some, I think in 2000, I got some video of it. But in 1997, I went on a Larry King show with Senator McCain, may he rest in peace, and the former owners of the UFC, Bob Meyerowitz and a fighter named Ken Shamrock, a very famous Hall of Fame fighter. And I said, with a sport that advertises no rules, no holds barred, anything goes. That was their advertisement in those days. Two men enter the cage, one leaves. I said, until we have a form of rules, we cannot have the fight in the state of Nevada. So then in late 2000, we had what is now called the unified set of mixed martial arts rules. I believe it was early 2001 in the state of New Jersey with Larry Hazard, their chairman, as well as their lawyer, Nick Wimble, and various stakeholders. We hammered out what are now called the unified rules, which have been adjusted a little bit as time went by, but pretty much what we adopted in 2001. In September that year, we had our first fight with Vladimir Marashenko and Tito Ortiz.
And then 2006 was when the Fertitta brothers and Dana White approached you about joining the UFC?
Late 2005. Lorenzo said, have you ever thought about leaving the commission? I said, no, I felt that I had the best commission job in the world. I mean, look at the big fights we've had. And so he said, well, you know, I want to talk some more. And we talked some more, and then it became the first of the year. And Lorenzo was a very good salesman, but then he brought what I call the closure. Dana came for breakfast. It was just Lorenzo and I and Dana. And we never talked about money or anything. They just said, look, if you get the sport, you can help us grow the sport. We would love for you to come. And I said, let me talk it over with my wife, with my family, some other mentors. And I said, okay, I will come. I have De La Hoya fighting Ricardo Mayorga, Cinco de Mayo. I'll come as soon as that fight's done. So I started, I believe, May 6th, 2006. 16 years ago. I never looked back, but I still go to fights. In fact, I'm looking forward to Triple G coming up in a couple of weeks against Canelo.
And you had a previous relationship with Lorenzo. He used to work for the commission, I believe.
Lorenzo Fertitta was one of the commissioners during my time as director. He also was a high school football player. I was a high school referee, and he remembered me from that. So we had a relationship, yes.
What did he play in high school? Football or?
Yeah, he was playing. He was probably a defensive back, not a real big back, but a good player, yes.
Was it hard to leave the commission? You know, it's probably the most respected commission, so you've got one of the biggest, most respectable jobs in combat sports.
Yes. Took me about over 3 weeks to decide, and yeah, I loved it. I loved the big fights. I loved the weigh-ins and being part of it. But it was a chance to be on really on the ground floor of a new sport. And in my discussions with Dana and Lorenzo, we never discussed worldwide stuff. They said you go to New York sometimes, you'll help us in state capitals. But we didn't talk about Brazil or Poland or Czechoslovakia or Russia. So that was all part of it in the end.
So just describe to us, Mark, what exactly is your position? What are your day-to-day roles?
Well, my day-to-day role, in the beginning, it was working with the different states, going to state capitals in America. Not only me, we had lawyers involved, and it was a team effort. And you have to have lobbyists. When you go to any state, you can't just walk into a legislator's office. You have to have appointments. And one by one, we got either the commission or the states to approve until we came to New York, which took us 8 years to approve. That was not about the sport of mixed martial arts. That was more about a labor union problem for the Hotel Workers Union in Nevada. which they have their brethren in New York go to the politicians, and we couldn't get a vote. The Speaker of the House wouldn't give us a vote. Finally, in 2016, we got a vote overwhelmingly, and our first fight was in Madison Square Garden with Connie.
You said in a previous interview you actually went over to, you know, the UK, my home, yes, and kind of offered it to them, but they weren't interested.
I met with the British Boxing Board, and I had known them and from boxing, and did a lot of work with different English boxing people and fighters. But they said we're a boxing group, and we're really not interested. Now, the last time I was in London, I met, just they came to the fights, and they said, you know, you were right. This is, it's fun. But we still haven't, I haven't heard much from them since. I respect them very much, and boxing is a great sport. And look at the crowds they get at Wembley. They have 97,000 or whatever it is with Tyson Fury. No, it's I think the sport is when the heavyweights are good, boxing is great.
So you liaise with the commissions, Mark, and obviously, you know, France has just approved MMA, and they're going to be doing a fight there shortly. Are there any new territories that you're working on currently that we could see MMA?
Well, we are going to Paris September 3rd. I think I leave a week from next Tuesday or right after that, 2 weeks. So it's not very long. I'm working with their sports minister and their French boxing group. And I believe, and nobody's officially ever talked about this really, but I think you will see South Africa in the future, and we'll start working there. Maybe it's a year and a half, 2 years away, but I could foresee a fight in Johannesburg someday. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the Middle East that it could be. We're going back to Abu Dhabi this I believe October. Abu Dhabi's been fabulous with us. Fight Island has been tremendous. It really helped save the sport in a lot of ways during the COVID crisis. We never stopped working here. Even during the big year of COVID, we still had 40 fights. So we kept everybody busy. Dana never laid off a soul, and the sports have grown just tremendously.
Well, so Matt, when you go to other territories, sometimes you do self-regulate. Can you just describe to the listeners how that works?
Yeah, so in London, that we were just there a couple of weeks ago, since there is no governing body, that's what I wanted the British Boxing Board to be. We have now formed a UK mixed martial arts that we're working with. And so when I say self-regulate, we'll assign the judges, we'll select them, we'll keep score, we'll do everything. All the medicals are the same. We'll do everything as it would be if it was in the state of Nevada. So it's as official as can be. And it's, you know, I hope the day it comes when there is a governing body, but to grow the sport in some of these countries, this is what we have to do. And we've been all over Europe. And as I said, we've been to Japan, and we self-regulate in Abu, and we'll just keep growing the sport. It's a worldwide sport. And hopefully, like I said, someday in Johannesburg.
When you're assigning, you know, the judges and the referees, Mark, what happens when you get like a fire, for example, you know, Dominic Cruz, and I can't remember for the life of me the referee's name, you know, when he lost the fight and he blamed the referee, he said he smelled of alcohol and cigarettes or something like that. What do you do when you assign a referee for, you know, Dominic Cruz, for example, his next fight? Is that something you look at?
Yes. Yeah, in all sports, I assign also for high school and some college stuff. If there's a major conflict that's been, let's say that there was one judge had it for one way in boxing or in MMA, and the fighter was really upset with corner, there's no reason to give that fighter the same judge again. I have enough judges. I have enough referees. I would make it a point to look at the history. 99% of the time, it doesn't matter. But in this case, the referee he didn't want wasn't even working the fight. So, but when we go to the UK, we send a letter to all the prospective judges and referees. Do you have any conflicts with any of these fighters? Are they, because a lot of judges now, they roll around the referees. They're in the gyms. And if they roll around with some of the fighters that could be on the card, we want to know. So we send them a questionnaire and make sure of that. Same thing in Paris.
When you first, you know, appointed to the UFC, it was still relatively new. So what happened with, you know, a lot of the commissions? Did they go away? Did they get training? Did they have to go to seminars to learn about, you know, the MMA rules? Because a lot of the judges you do see, they mix over between boxing and UFC or MMA.
Not too many more now. Most of them do one or the other. There are some, but for the most part. No, we had to do a lot of education, a lot of video presentations. Herb Dean, John McCarthy, Mark Goddard, they all have seminars. Andy Foster from the state of California has a Zoom meeting about every 2 weeks where any state can watch. So we're constantly doing that. And let's say we're going to, we'll say Florida for the first time. And I know maybe 10 weeks out, I will go to that commission. I'll make a special trip and meet with them and talk about what we expect, what we need and from the commission. There's not very many states we haven't been to, but I would still do that, yes.
If there's a controversial decision or, you know, something unusual happens in a fight, do you automatically, you know, sit down with the officials and you'll go back through and, you know, talk it through? Or do they like set, you know, a meeting a week later and they go over something, what happened and how it can be improved?
What we've done in the state of Nevada, we started this 25 years ago, that night, as soon as the fight's over, while everybody's fresh, if we had one judge had it 3-0 and one side and one had it 0-3, the other way, then I would ask him, I said, what did you see? In boxing, I used to bring the judges in to watch the film if it was what I felt was a real egregious or a controversial score. But it is a judgment, and we want them to learn. Most of my judges now, they get copies of the video that night, or they'll film them, and they'll study the video, and they'll call me and say, you know, that was a real close round. Maybe I should have had a 10-9 the other way. So, constant learning.
Yeah, definitely. Are you frustrated, Mark? Would you like to see, like, one committee in the US? Kind of like, you know, the British Board of Boxing in the UK? I know it's probably so much easier since the UK is so much smaller, but do you think it would just be good to have, you know, the committees all singing off the same hymn sheet?
If it could be done, what you have in America, states' rights issues, and the commissions, they don't want a federal oversight, but there's a few things that need to be done no matter what. There is an association of combat commissions that's loosely in charge of this, but not mandated. But what I would want is a bank where all medicals go, that any commission can go to that bank. And so we wouldn't have to have a blood test here and 6 months later there. Maybe they could all just have one test, one MRI, one eye test a year, something like that would be very helpful. In case you want to know, I am not for open scoring. You may want to ask that further in this interview, but I believe
it's on my notes. It's on my notes.
Advocate for leading the way it is.
And we'll delve into that since you brought it up, Mark. Why are you not in for open scoring? I know that some people say that, for example, in the UFC, you're winning by two rounds. In the third round, all you're going to do is kind of skip around the ring and, you know, try to avoid any contact.
Yeah, there's a lot to that. There's a lot to, if you're winning by two rounds and you get them on the ground, you might want to lay on them for a while. So if I was a corner man, no matter what, I'd say, look, if we're going to the third round, could be 1-1, better fight your butt off. I would never have a corner man say, man, you're doing great. You're up 2-0. Should never do that. Same thing in a championship fight. But this is a silly reason for me, but I believe in it wholeheartedly. The most exciting moment, especially in a championship fight, whether it's boxing or MMA, that goes a distance and you don't know who won. And you're waiting for Michael or Bruce Buffer to say the words, either still or new. And everybody's just waiting for it. It's on the edge of their seats. It's a very iconic moment that I would hate to lose in combat sports.
No, I've never thought of it like that. That's very true. Yeah, because you get that moment of adrenaline, you know, like who's won. And especially the person that has won, they're still waiting to find out. So, yeah, I never thought of it that way. Are you a fan of the video replays, which has been implemented in Nevada, but not every state so far?
Very much so. You want to get it right, get what happens right. We had a very unusual situation, which I was very pleased with the commission. We had a tap where the referee was on the other side. Nobody saw it. On the video replay, we didn't see it. So we pulled the judges. The commission pulled the judges. One judge had a perfect position and could see the tap, and therefore it was a girls' fight. The right winner happened. So yeah, that's unusual, but the replays have been great, and there's more states are doing it. I've always believed in it for 20 years or more, so I think this time has come and the technology is better. We have a complete replay system with the UFC. We don't even have to go to the TV truck. We have some electronic scoring now, but we have the backup with the commission. So we're always trying to evolve. Excuse me.
One thing I know that a lot of the fans said they'd like to hear, are you for or against officials speaking to the media afterwards and kind of giving reasons why they did what they did?
It doesn't do any good, because the ones who don't, all you do is prolong the argument. If you're working for a state commission, let them do it. And they can speak for you, but no, I don't think the officials should ever be quoted. And then I'm always concerned. I would never want an official to knock a fellow official. I think that's against the code, maybe an unwritten code, but I feel strongly about that. Think about soccer or any sport. You don't hear from the official. I mean, you never heard somebody saying, boy, Chelsea, I got screwed by this referee. Let's talk to the referee. You don't hear that. That's not the way it works.
We've just kind of got over, you know, the pandemic. We're coming out of the other side of what seems to be COVID. How did it impact your role, and how do you think it impacted the UFC?
I think I left the office when it first started. This was in 2002. Maybe 3 weeks, and I came in every day. Most everybody stayed away. I had, as the time went by, both shots and the booster shots. As I mentioned earlier, with the COVID, we didn't travel much, but Abu Dhabi kept us going. The state of Florida, the state of Texas, we went to Jacksonville. We've been several times to Texas. Their governors were a little more open with their states. So, with ESPN, there wasn't a lot of programming, and a lot of people started watching more. And so with the COVID, by keeping it going, it was very good in a bizarre way for the sport of mixed martial arts and the UFC.
Kind of rewinding a little bit, did you get frustrated, Mark, when you were, you know, the head of Nevada, when, you know, back in the day, you could ban them in Nevada, they could just go to another state, you know, and fight?
No, that once we had these unified rules in boxing, especially in now MMA, every state has to report their fights. And if the state of Nevada suspended somebody for 60 days, all the other states would say, okay, they wouldn't let them fight.
Well, we did have a recent one of Chavez. Remember when Chavez was supposed to fight in Nevada, then they moved it to Arizona?
Yeah, Julio Cesar Chavez Jr.
Yeah, because he was banned in Nevada for...
It was an administrative... I believe Arizona should not have let him fight. And then he was overweight, and he got... I'm going to get a drink of water while we're talking. Just back up here. Hold on for a minute. Almost ready. Okay, go ahead.
So, Matt, performance enhancing drugs in combat sports. Do you think we will ever be able to kind of keep up with the scientists that keep evolving? We always seem to be, you know, one or two steps behind.
Okay, there will always be some people who try to get around the rules. Now, we're very blessed with the USC that we have a man by the name of Jeff Nowitzki, who is our liaison with the United States anti-doping that have places all around the world. We test fighters anytime, 365, 24, they can be tested. And we take it very seriously. Periodically, we still catch somebody if somebody tries to beat the system. But with this, it's much, much better for us that we've been able to test them. And we spend a lot of money doing this. Most fighters are tested 3 or 4 times a year. So I think we're much, much ahead of the world. And I really believe in it.
For people that are listening, Mark, for example, say Conor McGregor, he's a huge star in the UFC. Obviously, at the minute, he's off, you know, due to injuries. But if he was fighting, like, how many times would he get tested in a year?
I would say, and while you're injured, you may he didn't do this, but some drop out of the program, they retire. To come back, you have to, I think it's a 6 months of testing. But a fighter, whether it's John Jones, Conor, and any of the bigger names, probably I'd say 5 to 6 times, maybe more.
Looking back at your time again, you know, as the commission, I think I'm right in saying you were the head when there was actually a fixed fight between Thomas Williams and Richard, is it Melito?
Yeah, that would have been probably 97 or so. The FBI had some wiretaps. Richard Melito knocked Thomas Williams through the ropes onto the ground, onto a judge. And they were convicted. His manager and I believe Thomas Williams. Yeah, that happened in 1997. I remember it to this honor. I think on a John Ruiz card, maybe, that he ran or something like that.
So how did it come to light to you? Did you just get a phone call afterwards, or was there like rumblings beforehand?
The FBI contacted me. They didn't contact me before, after the fight, so that's how I found out.
And then I assume they were both lifetime banned from the sport?
I know they both went to jail, and I don't think that, to my knowledge, if Thomas went to the spot again, he might have. I don't remember.
You know, before your time, obviously, there was organized crime was, you know, prevalent in boxing, you know, throughout the U.S. Is there any other stories that come to light that you can remember that come to that sort of area of organized crime?
No, I mean, nothing that I saw. In the state of California, though, there was a trainer who I believe it was in a Shane Mosley fight where they found that they had put some water on the wrappings and turned them into like a plaster of Paris. And they had to stop the fight and make them rewrap because they tried to do something in that regard. But for the most part, states do a good job. The inspectors do a good job. So I have not heard much. Now, when you're talking about 50 years ago or more, that's a different story. More than 50 years ago.
Looking back over your career, Mark, what's your favorite arena that you like to attend fights?
Well, my favorite arena was the outdoors at Caesars Palace. No longer there, obviously. There's a swimming pool now. But there was something very special and iconic about that. Do I love going to the Garden in New York? Absolutely. I like going to the O2 Arena in London. But, you know, here in the state of Nevada, with our T-Mobile, the MGM, Mandalay, I've been to them all. But my very favorite was outdoors at Caesars.
What's your favorite country that you've attended a fight?
I would say, and I've been very blessed to go around, but I really enjoyed being in Australia and Sydney and Stockholm, Sweden.
What are the biggest differences in the crowds? Because obviously, you know, in the UK, they're very kind of, you know, tribal, that they're all, you know, football fans. So they're chanting and singing. And, you know, like when you watch fights in Japan, they're very quiet and they'll clap.
Right. Well, when we go to London, when we have UK fighters on the card, it changes everything. It's real special. Same when we're in Sweden, we try to have Swedish fighters. So you always want something there. Japan is a different part of thinking. But everywhere else, the crowds are enthusiastic. They know the sport now. You can hear the rise of crowd making noise when they see some holes, maybe almost a choke. So, I think they're much more educated. We broadcast, I believe, in 170 countries. So there's very few that don't know about it. And remarkably, we're having sellouts when we go on the road and the big crowds. And it's exciting. And that's a part that's fun. It makes it even more fun. The Apex is great, but with a bigger crowd, it's even more exciting.
Is there any countries that you would like to visit that you haven't so far? And maybe even catch a fight there?
Well, like I said, South Africa would be, I would love to go. And I would like, I guess personally, would love to do a fight in Tel Aviv. But I don't know. It just depends on do we have a big Israeli fighter? Probably not at this time. But we're always looking for that. We've had some great fights in Poland. We've had great fights in Czechoslovakia. And we'll go back to Mexico City next year. We're definitely going to Brazil in January with a big fight card. So I'm an older guy now. I can't go everywhere, but there's certain places I still love going.
Mike, is it hard in your role now and your previous role with the commission? Do you try not to get too close to fighters, especially when you're part of the commission? Because obviously you may have to, you know, do some discipline later down the line.
Yes, I very seldom have anything socially to do. I shake their hands. I wish them well. But that's it. Yeah, I learned that a long time ago. But you love a fighter, you like Ray Leonard, and or you like Hadley, or whatever it is, and you feel bad yourself afterwards. So, inside my head, I might want a guy to win, but I stay away from him.
What's it like working for somebody like Dana White? Because he seems to be such a forward thinker. You've got, you know, the UFC PEI, you have the Apex. I believe he either has or is going to create a hotel for the fighters. So everything's kind of kept within the business.
What you see on TV is the way he is in the office. He makes me smile every day when I see him. He's already in Utah right now. But he's like a fan. He's very passionate about the sport. He loves the sport. And if there's a bad decision or a fighter doesn't fight hard, he voices his opinion as a fan would do. And if when we're sitting ringside and he thinks a decision is bad or a referee stopped the fight too early or too late, he'll let me know. And then I talk to the officials too. He's a great man to work for and with, and I enjoy him.
It's funny how over the last 20 or 30 years, it's hard now to find a boxing gym, but you can now walk down the street and quite easily find an MMA gym or a jiu-jitsu gym.
That's very true. That was one of my selling points going from state to state. I would tell the legislature, do you know where the local boxing gym is here? And for the most part, you wouldn't. But you have karate and jiu-jitsu, as you said, judo, on street, on just little shopping centers and around. And now you're having bigger and bigger gyms. But that's how the sport's evolving. Now you're seeing kids, like this week in Abu Dhabi, there's a big amateur tournament for MMA. And I think it's all maybe 14 and under. So you're seeing kids grow up with the sport. And now some of the fighters are much more advanced than they were 10 years ago. So the sport's really evolving and growing.
Mike, you were actually lucky enough to be in one of the Rocky movies. How did that come about?
They knew me from the Athletic Commission. I'll give you one quick story there. I was refereeing football in South Bend, Indiana. I had a Notre Dame game, very famous football, American football university, playing Brigham Young, and had my cell phone. There was eight of us in the car, or something like that. And they said, is this Mark Ratner? I said, yes, Mr. Stallone's on the phone. So now who would believe that? So I said, sure, this is, you know, I think somebody's pulling my leg. And yes, it was him. I put my phone on speaker and everybody could hear his voice. And he said, we're going to do a Rocky Five or whatever the number was, Rocky Balboa. And we're going to need some help. You'll have a little role in it. Are you interested? And of course I was. You know, I think it took about 10 days. The boxing is so meticulous and different views of that. But I had a big line, two lines. I had to weigh them. So my part was the actual guy weighing the fighters, my real role. And I said, Rocky Balboa, 221. And it was Mason the Line Dixon, 217, something like that. And I still get like $20 every 6 months for a residual just by speaking those lines. So that was a big thrill.
So did you give your opinion on how to make it look realistic? Is that something they asked you as well?
I helped them with putting the judges' chairs. And there were certain questions they had. But overall, they had done enough. Boxing is easy in movies because there's not a lot of views you have to worry about. I mean, they have different views of the fights themselves, but it was about 10 days of shooting, and I got paid for it, and residuals. So.
Do you have anything left on your like combat sports bucket list, Mark? You've done so much over your career. Is there anything less that you know, would like to do, like to achieve, like to visit?
Well, I keep on going back to South Africa, and I think that's a big step, especially with all our African fighters now we're getting. But I just keep growing the sport, being part of it. As I said, I'm a little more older than anybody here. Everybody's in their 30s, 40s, early 50s, so I'm a little bit older. But knock on wood, as long as I have the energy, I still enjoy it a lot.
I believe that you do something with the Las Vegas Raiders.
I do. I was working last Sunday. I am what is called the coach-to-player operator, where the offensive coordinator will talk to his quarterback, the defensive coordinator will talk to his captain, and I have a microphone switch. So I open the mics and close them when there's 15 seconds on the clock.
Can you actually hear what they're saying, or no. It's just a timer?
Yeah.
And are you still refereeing or involved in college sports as well?
I'm still involved as a timer for the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I'm the shot clock operator. I'm doing some USA basketball a week from tonight, I believe, with the United States developmental team against Uruguay. Will be some stars on there. So, yeah, I still have my hand involved.
You're probably one of the busiest men in sports, Mark.
Well, I'm delighted. It's been a great ride for me.
So looking back on your career, when you first started, you know, like as a volunteer, could you even dreamed of the amount that you've accomplished?
No. I came over here helping to grow the sport. And I never thought a guy would fly into the ring. I never thought a guy would bite a guy. So I've had some iconic moments. Because of those moments, the International Boxing Hall of Fame put me in. Getting all these states done here with the USC, that I've been lucky enough to be in their Hall of Fame. So, yeah, I've had a wonderful career.
And you recently released a book. Is that something that was that a goal of yours, or did somebody approach you?
More a goal of my family and Endeavor, having bought us. They have a publishing company called William Morris, another book agency, and they said, we want you to write a book. So I did. And when I say write it, I had telephone interview after interview and a sit down with the author. That's how you write a book these days.
So anybody that's listening wants to purchase that, it's Ringside, My Life Outside the Ropes and the Octagon. And it can be found on Amazon and all good, you know, book selling places.
Amazon for sure.
One question mark that I always like to finish on.
Good.
Somebody that's listening to this that wants to kind of follow in your footsteps, you know, work for the commission, what advice could you give them?
My advice would be to start as an inspector. The inspectors that I started, they're still 25 years ago now in Nevada. He's the chief inspector. I think that's the way to really do it. I tell everybody, we always need football officials and basketball officials. Go to your local association and start off with Little League football and you know, the smaller kids and learn where to be on the court or on the field. That's the key.
And Max, just want to say thank you for giving me an hour of your time today. The floor is kind of yours. Anything you've got coming up, anything you want to kind of advertise, whether it be upcoming UFC events, your social media, your book, anything?
No, I fly to Salt Lake tonight. All I would say is we have a big fight in Utah tomorrow with Usman. And so I'm looking at Leon Edwards, your Englishman, is fighting. So, I think we've had, we're in the midst of 12 weeks in a row of fights. So we've had a lot of fights. So, yeah, just keep watching. And then I enjoyed the interview. And now I'll say adieu.
And you can find us at TLR MMA on Instagram and Twitter. And join us next time. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Last Round MMA Podcast. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes and interviews. In the meantime, follow The Last Round MMA on Twitter and Instagram at TLR MMA.